Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the program today, undoing Iranian sanctions, maybe. Keeping an eye on the Russians, definitely. And rock climbing, socially. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the last day of March today, Tuesday the 31st. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Deadlines, you guys, are not all they are cracked up to be. Sometimes they focus the mind. Sometimes you can just ignore them. Negotiators in Switzerland trying to wrap up the Iranian nuclear talks there have chosen option B, ignore. Enough progress is being made, they said, that it's worth extending things a day or two. Because these are complicated talks, lots of moving parts. But if they do actually reach a deal, lifting sanctions on Iran is going to be no simple thing either, as Marketplace's Annie Baxter reports.
The sanctions against Iran have hammered its economy, throttled its oil exports, and choked off investment there. Iran wants the sanctions lifted as soon as any deal goes into place. Elizabeth Rosenberg is director of the Energy Economics and Security Program at the Center for New American Security. She says sanctions typically are not there one day, gone the next.
And so for everyone thinking that there would be a flood of commerce into Iran on day one of a nuclear deal, they're thinking about this wrong. They're going about it wrong.
Rosenberg says even if the six major powers hash out a deal by the final deadline of June 30th, there will be yet more hurdles. She says the European Union, for example, will have to get consensus from all 28 member states.
And that's been a challenge in the past when it comes to Iran, getting everyone on the same page.
Rosenberg says it's even more complicated in the U.S., which has some of the most powerful sanctions in place. There are also some sharp disagreements here between the president and Congress over whether to ease sanctions. Suzanne Maloney at the Brookings Institution says the president has some ability to waive sanctions, but only on a temporary basis.
The president will, in most cases, have no more than 180-day waiver authority, and in some cases even less.
And some members of Congress want to limit his powers even further. Maloney says with that much uncertainty about how all this will unfold, businesses are going to be very cautious about any investment in Iran for the foreseeable future. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
It's not every day you see a corporate press conference that includes Rihanna and Madonna and those two guys from Daft Punk up there in their robot helmets. But they and a stage full of other big-name music acts were in New York yesterday for the debut of a new music streaming service. It's called Tidal, T-I-D-A-L, the latest and quite possibly boldest move for rapper-slash-entrepreneur Jay-Z. Think music company for musicians by musicians. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn has more.
Back in 2009, Jay-Z left Def Jam to release an album on his own Roc Nation record label. I don't get drops, I drop the label. With Tidal, he's once again turning the tables on the labels. With streaming services like Spotify, the major record companies get not just music royalties, which they share with artists, but equity in Spotify, which they don't share, according to music lawyer Dina LaPolt.
So the recording artists did the same thing the major labels did. They said, you're not going to share your equity interest with us, so we'll just buy our own streaming service.
So instead of the labels, recording artists, or at least the ones on stage with Jay-Z, will profit if Tidal hits it big. And Kara Duckworth at the Recording Industry Association of America says it is entering a growing market.
About a third of revenues are generated from streaming music services.
But does being artist-owned mean Tidal will actually send more of that revenue to the millions of artists whose music it streams? Industry analyst Mark Mulligan thinks that's unlikely.
In terms of the brass tacks of what an artist actually gets paid, there really isn't that much that Tidal can do.
Mulligan says streaming margins are thin, and even the superstars on stage only get the share of royalties their record label contracts allow. And the biggest problem? Tidal's only going after people willing to pay a subscription fee.
If you look at it as a percentage, it's about 2 or 3% of the entire U.S. population currently pays for these services.
Artist-owned or not, paying for music is a tough sell. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
You know what else was a tough sell today? Stocks, because everybody was selling. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. foreign policy eyes are on Iran, as we said at the top of the newscast. But the world is a busy place, as you know, which explains why there are about 3,000 American troops and accompanying tanks and helicopters and gear in the Baltics right now, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. The events of the past year or so in Ukraine and Crimea have those former Soviet republics keeping a wary eye on Russia, Latvia, with a large Russian population especially. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more now from the capital, Riga.
This may not sound like the front line in a new Cold War with Russia, but that's how it feels to Latvian dairy farmer Uldis Krivas. He's a casualty of the war.
We are fighting for survival. You can run on empty for 3-6 months, but then at some point this downward spiral, and then it's very difficult to recover from that.
Krivas has seen his milk prices slump well below the cost of production. Latvia is awash with milk because Russia retaliated against EU sanctions by banning food imports from Europe.
This must mean you're very unhappy about these sanctions.
Yes, the sanctions are hitting us, especially the farm business, but I believe the sanctions should have been done and they have to be much stronger. We are still worried about our independence.
Marchers sing a patriotic song on a procession through the streets of Riga. Independence is still a raw subject here. The country only threw off Soviet rule 24 years ago. Liana Lange, a Latvian poet, claims that Putin wants to turn the clock back and rule Latvia again.
Trying to restore empire. He's trying to restore empire. Putin can think only as a KGB guy because he comes from KGB.
Some members of Latvia's large Russian minority dismiss that as pure paranoia. They don't believe Putin has any designs on the Baltic states. Alexander Gamalayev deplores the sanctions against Russia.
I think that it's very bad for Latvia to be a part of this campaign because Russia is our bigger neighbor. And economically, it's very bad for Latvia.
In fact, although the dairy farmers are reeling, Latvia overall has not been that badly affected by the crisis. It has cost about 1% of GDP, but the economy is still growing at a cracking pace, more than 4% a year. The Caravela fish processing plant in Riga. Like many Latvian firms, Caravela is diversifying away from Russian markets. Spokeswoman Cynthia Skatsani says the company now sells most of its herrings and sprats in Europe.
So we increase more and more export and clients in this part of the world to feel comfortable and safe.
Since regaining independence, Latvia has pursued the same policy, turning away from Russia and embedding itself in the West, joining NATO, the European Union, even adopting the euro for added security. I spoke with Andreas Pildagovich, State Secretary at the Foreign Ministry.
Do you feel that Putin would not dare to intervene here?
We clearly feel safe, but of course, if history teaches us anything, it teaches us that we cannot be complacent.
The biggest fear is that Putin might do a Ukraine and stoke up trouble using Latvia's Russian-speaking minority. But economist Morten Hansen says, quite apart from EU and NATO membership, there's a big difference between Ukraine and Latvia. Latvia is more prosperous and content.
In terms of income per person, we are ahead of Ukraine by a factor 3-1. I mean, this is a huge transformation. We were at the same level as Ukraine 22 years ago. Now we're 3 times richer.
And this, he says, is Latvia's ultimate shield against Putin's mischief-making, economic self-interest. In Riga, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
California Governor Jerry Brown signed a billion-dollar water plan last week, mostly to improve water infrastructure, how it's stored and transported from where it is to where it's needed. It's just the latest try out here at manipulating nature. Because 100 years ago, William Mulholland, the chief engineer of the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, was trying to figure out how to do the same thing and save this city. Lee Standiford has written a new biography of Mulholland, for whom the drive is named, by the way. It's called Water to the Angels, William Mulholland, His Monumental Aqueduct and the Rise of Los Angeles. Mr. Standiford, it's good to have you with us.
My pleasure to be here.
Give us a scale, would you? A sense of, you call it his monumental aqueduct. How monumental was it?
The very concept to move an entire river about 250 miles away in the Sierra Nevada, across the desert, through mountains, over these great chasms, to a city by the ocean, and do it entirely by gravity, engineer it with a pocket compass and an aneroid barometer. That's an amazing feat.
Where did the idea come from of going all the way up to the Owens Valley, which is all in the back of beyond, far away from L.A., on the other side of the Sierra Nevada, to get the water? Who thought of this?
Mulholland was very forthcoming in giving credit to former Mayor Fred Eaton. When things got bad in Los Angeles in the mid-1890s, he began to try to interest people in the concept of bringing that water all the way to Los Angeles.
Bad, you mean we were running out of water, right?
As early as 1894, yeah. Mulholland was fielding tons of complaints from folks whose water was fishy, from people who lived on the third floor of apartment buildings that couldn't get water pressure. Finally, it got so bad there after the turn of the 20th century, he said to Fred Eaton, "Why don't you show me the source of water you've been talking about forever, Fred?" And they jumped into a buckboard, and it is said that you can trace their route from Los Angeles to the Owens Valley by the glint of the whiskey bottles that they tossed off into the moonlight. Mulholland took a look at that river, and he said, "You know, I think we can do it. I think we can bring this river to Los Angeles."
Los Angeles gets the water. Owens Valley, to be kind, gets the really short end of the stick. I mean, it's an environmental disaster up there. There are toxic dust clouds for decades, and the river is taken from them.
Particularly the south end of the valley, but there have been a lot of mitigation efforts.
Yeah.
If the water had stayed, we would be growing an awful lot more alfalfa in the Owens Valley than we are today, but who knows what would have become of Los Angeles?
Well, what would have?
Engineers figure that 200,000 people, perhaps 250,000 people could be sustained on the natural water supply in ordinary years, not in these past 4 years, that the Los Angeles River could support about 250,000 residents there in the basin.
What does Mulholland say if he could come back to life today and he looks at Los Angeles?
I wish he were alive so I could ask Mr. Mulholland, "We're running out of water in L.A. again. What do you think we should do?"
Yeah.
What he would say, I'm not sure. There are no more undiscovered rivers to tap. Now, whether he would turn toward desalinization or some other conservation project yet unknown, I'm not sure. But his big bugaboo all his life was the fact that people just wouldn't stop coming to Los Angeles. And no matter if you get enough people, it doesn't matter how low the rate per capita of water consumption is, sooner or later you run out.
It's a book called Water to the Angels, about Los Angeles and William Mulholland and the aqueduct that he built. Les Standiford, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up.
If you're an office drone sitting there all day, you kind of want to get your hands dirty and get blistered and chalked up a little bit.
Go climb a rock, will you? But first, let's do the numbers. End of the day, end of the quarter, too. So first, the day, the Dow Industrial's off 1.1%. That is 200 points, closed at 17,776. The NASDAQ backed up 0.9%, 46 points, 4,900 even at the close. The S&P 500 gave away 0.8%. That is 18 points. Closed at 2,067. For the quarter, the Dow off 0.3%, the first down quarter since the fourth quarter of 2012. The NASDAQ picked up 3.5%. The S&P 500 added 0.4%. Oil told the daily story once again, with crude prices moving lower and an Iran deal still in the offing, maybe, perhaps, kind of, sort of. Energy shares were squeezed. Phillips 66 poured off more than 1%. ExxonMobil drained 0.75%. Marathon gave back about 0.5%. Today on the upside, JCPenney jumped more than 7% after an analyst lifted its target on the retailer share price. In a deal dependent on another deal, I know this gets complicated, Charter Communications said it would buy Bright House Networks for $10 billion if the Time Warner Comcast merger goes through. Charter steered up 5% on that news. Liberty Broadband also in the mix, by the way, picked up more than 5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. It's April Fool's Day, but you've probably already stuck a post-it on your forehead so you won't forget. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for February. And 45 years ago tomorrow, before you could fast forward through those pesky advertisements, President Nixon signed legislation that banned cigarette commercials from running on TV and radio. It took effect the following year. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. High school seniors are smack dab in the middle of what is either the best or the worst couple of weeks of their young lives. It is college acceptance time, which means it's also, for a lot of families, figure out how to pay for college time. But imagine, if you can, a place where you pay nothing to go to college, not one thin euro. How's that for a hint? Over the next couple of days, we're going to take a look at higher education in Germany to see what we might learn, possibly, from their model. From WGBH, Kirk Carapetta starts us off with the real costs of free.
It's a frigid evening on the banks of the Rhine in the medieval city of Cologne. Under the vaulted ceiling of an old Gothic church, the university orchestra is tuning up. In the land of Beethoven and Handel, it makes sense that a university would invest a lot in its orchestra. But that commitment extends far beyond the music program. The state pays for every student to study here.
Since tuition is free here, students really don't worry about student loan debt.
About what?
Student loan debt. Do you know what student loan debt is?
No.
No?
No.
In America, students now graduate with an average of nearly $30,000 of debt. But college in Germany has always been free. It's seen as a public good. Of course, there's a trade-off, as we learned firsthand touring the University of Cologne.
Okay, now, I have to be honest, I really like this university, even though it's not the most beautiful one.
Our tour guide, Valeria Schwartz, is one of 48,000 students here at Germany's largest university.
The place is swarming with bicycles. It looks like, you know, it looks like most of the students bike to school.
Yeah, that's normal in Cologne.
Students tend to stay local, so there are no dorms. No active student clubs either, and every lecture hall we poked our heads in was huge. This translates to savings. The average cost of an undergraduate degree in Germany is $32,000, paid for by the state.
Majority of German voters agree that, you know, a decent start in life includes the possibility of a free higher education.
That's Frieder Wolf. He teaches political science at another well-known German institution, the University of Heidelberg. Tucked in the heart of this quaint but vibrant city, the university offers a full program of courses, from ancient history to biochemistry. To limit spending, Wolf says, professors teach more and earn less than their American colleagues.
This is not to complain. I mean, I love my job and we've got a lot of freedom, but this is how we keep costs down, basically, larger classrooms. We've got courses with 40 participants, 50 participants.
Professors are also expected to handle a lot of their own paperwork.
Many administrative tasks for which you would have specialized personnel in the States is done by the teachers and professors here.
But do German students get the same learning experience? Professor Wolf says while they may not have top-tier colleges like Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, what they do have is reliable quality.
With all due respect, in the States you've got the best in the world, the best colleges, but you've probably also got some of the worst. Whereas in Germany, most everybody who wants to go to a college can go there. You'll get a decent education.
Still, we found German families who, despite the promise of free college, are willing to pay for the elite American experience. Johannes Kim and Jane Park live in Essen, a small suburb 50 miles north of Cologne. In the kitchen, their three young children are listening to an opera lesson on tape. Johannes graduated from the University of Heidelberg. He says the opportunity to build relationships with professors is something you really can't put a price tag on. And he wants their kids to attend schools with strong brand recognition.
the American college experience also is something that instills some sort of, I don't know, a very emotional bond to your university or to your college. That's something that is completely missing in the German system. Although I went to the oldest university in Germany, there was not a feeling of I'm a proud graduate alumni of that school.
Jane, who is Korean American, finds Germany's tuition-free model appealing, and she's conflicted about the American system.
I like to think that I have a strong sense of social justice, and great education is almost reserved for the elite in that sense, despite scholarship opportunities and financial aid. And in some ways, I am squaring, okay, do I want to feed my children into that sort of system?
Jane and Ioannis' kids are young, so it will be a while before they go to college. And by that time, there's no guarantee that Germany will still be committed to the idea of a free college education. I'm Kurt Carapeza in Cologne, Germany, for Marketplace.
People have been climbing hills and mountains and rocks forever. The Disruptor, which is really only a couple of decades old now, is doing that inside. The climbing gym, as I said, has been around for a while now, but there has been a boom of late. Claire Malone from The New Yorker has a new piece online about it. Claire, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Kai.
So I'll tell you, we were talking about this article at our morning meeting today, and there was a guy who said, I was down at the climbing gym this weekend, and it was packed. There were kids all over, and it was crazy, and birthday parties, and this and that. And it does seem that rock climbing now is becoming something.
It's a thing. It's very much a thing, and especially in cities like Los Angeles and New York.
And other places where actually they don't necessarily have mountains. I mean, that's one of the things you point out, is that like in the Midwest and all over the place, they have these climbing gyms, which are becoming a different way to work out, a different way to exercise, a different kind of business.
That's right. There are a lot of climbing gyms where, you know, there's not much rocky terrain. It's because these gym owners have figured out that they don't necessarily need people who have climbed, you know, Yosemite or Annapurna. They just need people who are sort of looking for a cool, different, alternative way of working out.
And you say largely millennials who enjoy these group activities.
That is definitely the demographic trend that's really growing.
Yeah.
I cited a study that the Outdoor Industry Association puts out where it shows that a lot of the spending in the outdoor industry, which sort of covers a range of different, you know, products and stuff, but it's a lot of young, affluent urban people. And, you know, no one quite has a handle on why, although there are lots of theories, I think. You know, one is that people really like it because it feels so real and so tangible, which is, you know, if you're an office drone sitting there all day, you kind of want to get your hands dirty and get blistered and chalked up a little bit.
I think the best line of the piece was, it's less frenetic than CrossFit, but what was it, grittier than SoulCycle, right? Spinning.
That's right. That's right. Greg Thompson, who's the head of Adidas, which is one of these mainstream sports brands that's getting into things, he told me that, you know, people really just like the idea of also being social when they're exercising. So you can go with a group of friends on a Friday night. Some gyms even have beers. You know,
it can't be good. Mountain rock climbing with beer in you, that's just a bad idea.
That did occur to me, but they're very much sort of marketing it to, you know, you don't have to have grown up bouldering and scrambling up rock outside.
And there is no small amount of social media in this thing, too. I mean, you talk about this 23-year-old climber who's got a gazillion followers on Instagram and the guys who did the Dawn Wall up in Yosemite and how they did the whole social media thing.
Right, yeah. Sasha DeJulian is a young woman who is a social media native. So she shares her climbs on Instagram. And, you know, if you've ever been a National Geographic lover, you will appreciate a climber's Instagram because they're these beautiful shots and there are these people doing these, they call it, you know, dynamic poses, right, up the rock wall. and one of the reasons why the Dawn Wall was such a sort of got so much national attention was these guys, Kevin Jorgensen and Tommy Caldwell, were doing video chats while they were on the face
on the
of the
side
mountain.
Of a mountain. It was insane.
Yeah,
are you kidding me?
It's crazy. And who doesn't love that? And I think it works the same way for regular Joe Schmoes who are doing climbing, right?
Right.
So old-fashioned word of mouth, but the new-fashioned way, which is social media.
Have you ever done it? Did you do it in the course of this thing? Come on.
I have done it. I have done it. I am not, by any stretch of the imagination, a hardcore climber. I didn't actually do it during the course of reporting this piece, but I did it on another story to prove my mettle.
There you go. Claire Malone from The New Yorker. Claire, thanks very much.
Thanks so much, Kai.
Just final note on the way out today, which I offer with one eye firmly on the calendar, tomorrow being the 1st of April and all, Amazon has announced something called Amazon Dash. It's for Amazon Prime members. They're tiny little sticker things with a button on them that come branded with various household products, Tide detergent, for instance, or Gatorade. The idea is that you put them in your pantry or your laundry room. They hook into your home Wi-Fi system, and if you need a resupply of whatever it is, say Tide detergent, you just push the button, and presto, your order is made. Now, I get the whole Internet of Things thing, but the opportunities here for peril would seem to be great.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And we are out of here. The Dow off 1.1% today. That is 200 points on the nose. The NASDAQ off 0.9%, 46 points. The S&P 500 gave away 0.8%. That is 16 points. Caitlin Esch, Millie Jefferson, and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our Marketplace desks. Our digital producers are Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner. Nishat Kurwa is the senior digital producer. I'm Kai Rizal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.